Welcome to Down the Yellow Brick Pod, your ticket somewhere over the rainbow and down many a yellow brick rabbit hole for all royal revisionists and fans of Oz to fall down together.
Today, you've landed in our Slipperhood series, where we interview many of the magical folks who identify with or have stepped into the legacy of the sparkly shoes, no matter if they are silver or ruby red, in a Broadway caliber production or homemade from the heart.
May Oz continue to connect us across gender identities, generations, and cultures, thanks to things like recognizable gingham, and inspire our next steps today. Rhys Thomas is an Emmy-nominated veteran of television production. He has written, directed, and produced more than 300 hours of documentary films for CNN, Discovery, History, A&E, National Geographic, Science, Fox, ABC, NBC, Weather, Military, Travel, and various other broadcast networks. His credits include Crimes of the Century, Unusual Suspects, Through the Wormhole with Morgan Freeman, Hoover Dam Reinvented, Undercover History, Howard Hughes, Combat Zone, LA Forensics, Sex in the Civil War, Sex in World War II, John F. Kennedy, A Personal Story, Biography, Robert E. Lee, Dwight D. Eisenhower, Commander-in-Chief, The Irish in America, and The Presidents. He is a national member of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. In addition to his prolific writing for television, Rhys was a contributor to the Los Angeles Times for several years, where he reported on the entertainment industry, culminating in his groundbreaking investigative report, The Search for the Ruby Slippers, which later became the genesis of his first book, The Ruby Slippers of Oz, and subsequent revision, The Ruby Slippers of Oz, 30 years later. In addition to his Ruby Slipper books, he is the author of Eternity's Trap, The Trial of Robert E. Lee, Danger Close, The Rescue of ODA 525, Hotel Street Harry, and Honolulu Harlot. Rhys is an avid skier and body surfer and an accomplished world-class croquet player. In 2013, he was inducted into the United States Croquet Hall of Fame and later the World Croquet Federation Hall of Fame. He also likes to cook. Rhys graduated from the University of California, Berkeley, with a degree in history. He lives in Los Angeles, California, with his wife, Michelle, and three cats. Derek has been under the spell of Judy and Oz since her farmhouse fell into his life during one of the annual TV showings of Oz in the early 80s. The fascination spread to a love of classic film, and today Derek works as a film editor for television, unsuccessfully trying to insert some old Hollywood glamour into renovation shows. In 2016, he edited and co-wrote The Slippers, a documentary tracing the strange history of Judy Garland's shoes, which was inspired by a book he purchased at age 12, written by Rhys Thomas. Oh, I just got chills. From home base of London, Ontario, Canada, Derek is soon to be releasing his own podcast, thanks to the guidance from the dynamic duo at Down the YVP, about Judy Garland's rocky but incomparable time at MGM. Welcome, dear listeners. MK here. And of course, Tara.
I'm here.
As always. We're so excited. Welcome to our first Slipperhood episode of season 4. Woo-hoo. We have two very special guests with us today. And honestly, we both could not be fangirling more. It's a holiday in Oz for us. Today, we are speaking with two special guests. We have our friend of the pod, Derek Lajeunesse, a film editor and co-writer of 2016's The Slippers documentary, which was inspired by a book written by our guest, Rhys Thomas, the Ruby Slippers of Oz, which has since been released and updated as a 30th anniversary edition. So we are so excited to talk all things Oz, old Hollywood, film, television, and of course, the slippers with two experts of experts. Ah! So thank you so much for being here, Rhys and Derek.
Applauding applause.
So happy to be here, guys.
Yeah, and likewise, good to be here.
Yay. So there's so much to get into, but just so our listeners hear a little bit more about you and your individual journeys and how it brought us here today, to kick us off, Derek, would you mind sharing with us your earliest introduction to the world of film, the entertainment industry, maybe even, we know you're our resident Judy lover on the pod.
Oh, and, yeah.
And maybe how that all intersected with the world of Oz and your career. Just, you know, some light topics. Can you do that in a, you know, short time?
I absolutely can. No problem. Because they're all in the same moment. It all ties together in the same moment for me. So I looked it up this morning because I wanted to see when, because I had a childhood memory of watching Oz on TV when it was broadcast in the early 80s. And I remember watching it. It was the Sunday before Christmas that it aired. And I just looked it up right now, and it did air that day. I looked it up in an old TV guide listing. So I'm like, my memory is correct that it aired December 18th, 1983. So that's the day everything started for me. I was six. So I was like you guys probably, The Wizard of Oz completely transfixed me. And I was used to seeing cartoons, but never like live action with actors. So what that did for me was it made me feel like there was another world going on of the people that were pretending. Like cartoons didn't seem, you know, I wasn't interested in the people. But for some reason, Judy Garland fascinated me in the fact that she, you know, had to learn lines and was pretending. And everything was shot inside. Because my mom told me these things. And I was like, what? How can this be? So that's when I started to really, really get into the love of movies, basically. My mom went out to the library and got and loaned out a book about child stars of the 30s, which probably had a lot of dark elements to it, but I didn't really notice that stuff. And so she told me about Judy Garland's life and basically went from there. And 6 years later was the 50th anniversary. And one of my purchases was Rhys's book. So that made... I was only 12, but that made a huge impact on me. And I, of course, thought about the shoes all the time, and the movie just gained more and more like momentum in my life. But Judy gained more momentum than Oz did. I sort of left Oz a little bit behind. But you guys have brought me back the past year or so. So, yeah, you've been good at that. So this always had an impact on my career. Like I didn't know when I say career, it's kind of a funny thing to say, but, cause I'd never really planned anything. So it just sort of happened. So, I went to school for history. I have a degree in history. And then I went to college about 6 years later got my, sort of specialization in film editing from a college, not a university. So in Canada, you guys call college university. I don't know what you call what we call college. Maybe you call it community college or more of a trade school. I don't know.
Sure. Right. Yeah, I feel like we use college and university interchangeably.
Yeah, interchangeably.
And then community like, yeah, college, more like an associate's degree before moving on to your bachelor's in a way.
Oh, so we don't have a sort of equivalent. Like it's interesting. Like we have universities, which are more academic, and we have colleges, which tend to be more preparatory for work and more skills based. But I went to school for media at a college in Toronto. And from there, I started editing and started working in editing. I'm still working in editing today. But everything is informed by old movies and my love of Hollywood. And I was so lucky that – I guess we'll get into the Slippers movie. But to have those things intersect for me for a brief moment was a highlight for sure. But The Wizard of Oz and Judy are always sort of like lurking behind me.
I love that. I love even that at age six, you went to the library and you were like, I'm researching. I got to look into this.
Yes. I have to know who this person that I'm so fascinated by is.
Yeah.
And why. Mm-hmm. Still don't know the answer, but yeah.
I'm very excited as our conversation progresses to see how
your journey and Reese's journey both sort of commingle together. So that brings us over to Reese. Hello, Reese. So kind of a similar question, but in a different vein, Reese, would you mind giving us and our listeners a brief highlight reel, if you will, of your professional career up until that fateful day that you visited the MGM script vault, which we will get into?
My career has seemed like an accident from the very beginning. I tripped over my shoelaces. I went to college up at Berkeley. I went to university at Berkeley.
Yes.
And I also studied history. I majored in history. And jumping ahead a bit, one of the courses I took, I always looked for history courses where novels were on the reading list. And one of the courses I took, The Wizard of Oz, was on my reading list. Now, I knew The Wizard of Oz, I'd been watching The Wizard of Oz since I was a kid. It debuted on television on CBS in the year of my birth, 1956. So now I've aged myself. And the course was very interesting, and I assume we'll get into my reasons for diving into the Oz story later. But coming out of college, I was basically a ski bum, and I took off and went and lived in Aspen for a few years. Found that I loved the summers more than the winters, even though I loved the skiing. But there came a time when I had to make some money. And I was doing a little writing in Aspen. I wrote a little bit for a startup newspaper called the Aspen Daily News. I think I wrote one piece and may have been paid something like $5. And I wrote another piece for Aspen Magazine that I spent probably 3 weeks on, a review of a play called Mass Appeal that Charles Durning and John Travolta were in that summer. And for those 3 weeks of work, I was paid $25. And I realized I could not make a living. I couldn't make a living in Aspen as a writer. And that's what I wanted to be. And I refused to tell people I was a writer until I could actually pay rent writing. And that brought me first back to Berkeley. And then a friend of mine was in the television business. He was on a daytime show, long forgotten, called Fantasy, starring Peter Marshall and Leslie Uggams. And he called me up and said, we need researchers. And I'm an academically trained researcher. I'm a library hound. But I figured, okay, I'll give that a try. And I went down for several interviews. And every time I went down for an interview, I thought it went well. And then I would find out that the research director had just been fired. So I had to go to back down and interview again. I ended up interviewing, I think, 3 or 4 times before I was finally hired at a massive sum of $300 a week, which was more money than I could ever have imagined making. Although while in Aspen, I was a waiter, and I did make good money as a waiter in Aspen. But I felt like I was finally starting to live up to the idea of writing for a living. And that television career sort of was a complete accident. I had no idea what I was doing. Unlike Derek, I had no formal training in broadcasting, in television, in film. I really had no background whatsoever in film history or anything having to do with the business. And what I did for this little TV show, it wasn't little, it was a big daytime show. But what I did for it was I was sort of a mix between a travel agent and a private investigator. My specialty was tracking people down for reunions. And that's how I got started in the business. I went on from there to become the assistant to the executive producers for a show called Thick of the Night, starring a Canadian, Alan Thicke.
Oh, yes.
And the sidekick, or the kick side, as I called him, was Arsenio Hall. I got to know Arsenio pretty well. I pretty much got to know everyone. Fred Silverman was one of the executives. So that was a real eye-opener for me. There's a movie called My Favorite Year.
Oh, yeah.
Starring Peter O'Toole. Thick of the Night was my favorite year in television. It was just so wacky. The whole thing was wacky. But from there, I moved on to when Thick of the Night collapsed somewhat epically. Fred got a show over at ABC and took a number of us over to work this show called The Love Report, and it was awful. And it was canceled within 5 weeks. It was so awful. And my friends started to, you know, refer to me as, the, you know, the death knell for any television show, because so far, first three shows I'd been on were all canceled. But that brought me to KBC and ABC and the affiliate KBC in Los Angeles. And from there, I started working on several different shows with the station, a morning show, an afternoon show, and then they had a syndicated show called Hollywood Close-Up. And it was Hollywood Close-Up where my relationship with The Wizard of Oz was rekindled. One of our producers, segment producer, I think maybe she was an associate producer. We all had weird titles back then. Gave me a tip. I was charged with writing a little segment about sort of the back rooms of Hollywood, a head of hopper type thing. And we had a host who was a very talented journalist at the LA Times named Deborah Caulfield. And so I was in charge of her segment. And I got this tip that this is 1986, that Ted Turner had just bought MGM. And the entire studio, and what he wanted were the films for his new cable TV or his cable superstation, which today is now TCM, or, you know, it became it's Turner Classics today, but it was the Turner Superstation. And there was a rumor that Turner himself had gone down into the MGM script vault in search of copies of Gone with the Wind, because he wanted to have a continuity script, a script from the movie that he could bring home to Atlanta and put on his coffee table and impress people. And I thought the rumor was fun, so I figured this is maybe worth a 2-minute segment or something. And so I called up MGM to find out, you know, what was going on and if the rumor was true. And what I was told was that the MGM script library was being split in half. And the reason was because the sale to Ted Turner by another mogul, Kirk Kerkorian, who had bought the studio earlier. He had actually bought the studio in 1969. So there's a lot of history here. And this all gets complicated very fast. But what happened was I was told that the library was being split in half. All the produced properties that went with actual films were going to Turner. The unproduced properties, which never became films, were going to stay with Kerkorian. In effect, the library was being split in half and completely dismantled. And this is the world's largest private film library in the world at the time. There were more than 250,000 scripts with over 3,000 produced properties in this library. And I thought, well, this would be great. They're going to, you know, this is the end of an era for a great institution in Hollywood. And so I figured, well, let's see if we can get down there and film it and maybe expand this segment out a little bit, maybe make it 3 minutes. And so I called up MGM, called up the big boss, the current president, who was a guy named Roger Mayer, no relation to Louis B. Mayer, but he was a very respected studio boss. And I expected, you know, it's going to take a week. I'm going to have to write a letter. I'm going to have to, you know, fax something over. I just figured there would be Hollywood bureaucracy. But within 5 minutes, I was given permission to go to the script vault. And wow. I thought, this is great. I did know from my history classes up at Berkeley that several of my literary heroes had worked at MGM. First being a distant relative, William Faulkner, who was a a cousin of my grandmother's. And then F. Scott Fitzgerald, Raymond Chandler. And I thought, all right, I want to go search out these scripts and find these works by these people and others. But I also was thinking in the back of my mind, they're packing up this library, and among the great Hollywood treasures is The Wizard of Oz. And the idea of putting, you know, Dorothy and all her fantastic friends into a cardboard box to be shipped off to wherever Turner wanted it to go, that sort of appealed to me visually as a good idea, a way to kick off the segment. So I asked the librarian there, who was in charge of splitting everything up, and that's a whole different story, where the Oz scripts were. And now I have them at the back of my mind. I know that in the book, the shoes are silver. And the reason they're silver is because they are part of a 19th century political parable. Wizard of Oz, the fairy tale, is actually great political commentary on the 19th century populism and has a lot to do with the gold standard and the silver standard. And the silver shoes represented the silver standard. The yellow brick road represented the gold standard. Oz is Washington, D.C. The Wizard of Oz is William McKinley, the president. The Cowardly Lion is William Jennings Bryan, who was running for president. The Scarecrow is the poor Kansas farmer who can't get his crops to grow and is in a terrible drought. And the Tin Man is the victim of Eastern industrialism. He's just been made to work so hard that he's rusting. The Wicked Witch of the East represents the Eastern industrialists, the captains of industry. The Wicked Witch of the West represents drought. How do you get rid of drought? You rain. How do you get rid of the Wicked Witch of the East? Or I'm sorry, how do you get rid of the Wicked Witch of the West? Throw water on her. Drought. So there we have the sort of a nutshell, a thumbnail of the political parable. And it gets more complicated. And there's a great essay by a man named Henry M. Littlefield titled The Wizard of Oz, Parable on Populism. And I highly recommend it to all Oz lovers because it's a fascinating essay. It was published in 1964 in the American Quarterly. He was just a high school teacher, but he wrote this epic piece of historical commentary on Oz. So I've got this in the back of my mind. When did the Hollywood change happen? When did the silver shoes become ruby slippers? And I started hunting through the scripts, and I found it. The script was dated May 14th, 1938, page 26, scene 113, where the directorial cue read close-up or CU, Dorothy's silver shoes. And silver had been scratched out, and up above it in handwriting had been written ruby. And that's where this historic Hollywood change happened. I got very excited about this. I was looking at history. I immediately went back to our shop and told our producer about it. And this was, you know, a fantastic thing. And the executive producer of our show said, "This is great. We can get this on the air right away. What's the script worth, do you think? How much money?" Which is a reasonable question for, you know, TV research. And I figured, well, that'll be another phone call. I'll call some bookstore and see if I can find out how much this script might be worth. And I started calling around and nobody had an answer. All they said was, "Well, bring it in. Let's look at it." Well, I didn't own it. It wasn't mine to bring in. So I kept calling around and around and around and getting no answers. I finally decided, well, let me try the Smithsonian Institution. I'll give them a call. And I got through to the head curator of the Department of Community Life, which is in the History Museum, the National Museum of American History. The Division of Community Life is part of that structure. And his name was Carl Sheely, very much like a Wizard of Oz type figure in stature, in demeanor, in kindness. And his response to me was, "We have great interest in that property. Would you donate it?" And I thought, what? And I said, well, I don't own it. MGM owns it. And he said, well, do you think MGM would be willing to donate the script to the museum? And so I called back to Roger Mayer's office and said, you know, the damnedest thing has just happened. I was trying to find out the value of this script I found in your library. And they asked if the Smithsonian wants to, they would love to have it as a donation. And Roger Mayer personally says to me, of course, we'll donate it. But that opened up a big can of worms, because I initially thought this is the story's just become 4 minutes long, maybe five. But but unfortunately, Carl Sheely tells me, I'm sorry, we cannot, you know, we ask that you don't publicize the notification of the donation before it's officially happened. And the reason is because if you do, people start showing up at the museum wanting to see it before it's ever there. And the donation was complicated because it involved copyrights, the movie copyright, the script copyright, and it was going to require a lot of bureaucratic red tape to make, because once you donate something to the Smithsonian, it becomes part government property. So MGM had to protect its copyright at the same time giving this script over. And that meant I couldn't run the story now for what I thought were going to be a couple of weeks. It turned out to be much longer than that. But in the meantime, I'd also been freelancing at the LA Times, writing little blurbs for the calendar section. And we had a wonderful editor there, a magnificent guy by the name of Irv Litovsky. Irv was very schooled in Hollywood. He was an old school journalist, just a fantastic editor, had a great stable of writers, and the writers in that stable have produced at least 100 books in the time since. But so I tell him about the Oz script and the silver shoes and the ruby slippers, and he looks at me and says, well, that sounds like a great sidebar. What happened to the shoes, kiddo? And those were his exact words. I'd never even thought about, you know, what had happened to the shoes, the ruby slippers. And so I said, oh, well, you know, television research, I'll make another call. I'll call the MGM costume department and ask where they are. And so I called them up and I spoke to a fellow who worked in the, you know, he'd been at the MGM costume department for many years. And I just said, so what happened to the ruby slippers? Where are they? And his response to that was, oh, God, you're not going to get into that, are you? And I thought, get into what? I thought, you know, they must know where the ruby slippers are. They're, you know, the big prop in this movie. And he says, well, Sammy Davis Jr. supposedly has a pair, and there's a lady down in Tennessee that's got a pair, and the Smithsonian's got a pair. And I said, wait. What do you mean? There's more than one pair? This was news to me. I'd always thought, you know, there's, you know, in the Land of Oz, there's only one pair of ruby slippers and everyone's after them. But in the Land of Hollywood, there are multiple pairs, because if a heel breaks on set, you got to have another pair ready to go. You can't wait for the shoemaker to make another pair. And that was my introduction to the Land of Hollywood. And I really fell into a rabbit hole. The first thing I said, well, I followed this up with this guy at the MGM costume department. I said, well, who knows what happened to them? He says, there's only one person in the world who knows the whole story of the ruby slippers. His name is Kent Warner. And I said, oh, great. Do you have his phone number? Can I talk to him? No, he's dead. And I found out he had died 2 years before one of the very first casualties of the AIDS epidemic. He had died in April of 1984, having contracted HIV probably in the late 70s, maybe very early 80s. He was listed as number 8 as an AIDS death in Los Angeles, very early. And so for the next 2 years, I chased a ghost. I tried to find out anyone and everyone who knew Kent Warner and who knew about his story about the ruby slippers. And that is how I got into the story.
I
mean, we're like leaning
I know. I could listen to Reese talk all day.
Sign me up.
This is my kind of story.
Yeah.
Just the fact that like, even like your initial reasoning to going to the archives, like Oz wasn't even the first thing. It just is so wild how all this unfolded, just like little bite after little bite. And like one person exclaiming one thing to make curiosities percolate on up. It's just so fascinating.
I should say as a side note, I did find an unpublished manuscript by William Faulkner called Manservant that eventually became sort of a character sketch for, I believe it was The Bear. I'd found that in there, and that thrilled me as well. Plus, I found a script that F. Scott Fitzgerald had been a script doctor on for a movie called The Women. And he had signed it at the top and had dated it every time he did a revision. And his handwritten revisions were all through this script. This script had been folded in half and stuffed into the side of a cardboard box. And I pulled it out. And I showed the librarian, who had no idea who Fitzgerald was. She'd never heard of him. I said, "This is a valuable piece of property here. You've got a script that with F. Scott Fitzgerald's handwritten notes on it, and he signed it." And she said, "Yeah, we got a lot of scripts like that." She folded in half again and stuffed it back into the side of the box. So that was a memorable trip down to that script vault. It really was going down into the rabbit hole of history.
That is incredible. Thank you for just detailing
and
putting everything into context. I've read your book multiple times. I've seen the Slippers documentary multiple times, but to get even more of behind the scenes is really, really exciting.
Before you do, I should, the final thing I'm going to say about the book is that I was never a big Oz fan. I was never a Judy Garland fan. I was never even a really big Hollywood fan, but I've loved biography. I love the idea of telling stories. John Dos Passos was a writer that I studied extensively in college, and he wrote these marvelous little mini biographies. And that's what I wanted to do with the book, was to include little mini biographies in it. And in effect, the entire book is a biography of Kent Warner.
Yes. I was going to say that. It's like the unauthorized biography of
Kent Warner, which is
beautiful that you were able to do that. Mm-hmm.
And I know you mentioned to us when we were chatting via email that it wasn't really about the slippers for you specifically. It was a lot about the chase. So I'm wondering if you could talk about your journey of how these stories became a book and how you even began to sort of structure those mini biographies, as well as documenting the very complex history of the slippers, as you've mentioned. How did you even begin to bring that all together?
Well, it's true. What appealed to me most was the chase. Was, okay, I've got a mystery here. What's, first off, where are the shoes? And it turns out there's more than one pair. So I went back to Irv Litovsky at the LA Times and said, guess what? There's more than one pair of ruby slippers. And I have a feeling he knew that already. But I said, and nobody knows where they are. Or nobody knows what really happened with them, that there's a pair at the Smithsonian that had been donated 1979, I believe. And there's a woman in Memphis, Tennessee that claims to own a pair, but there's this shadowy figure, this fellow Kent Warner, who allegedly stole all the pairs but one from MGM in 1970, when this is right after Kirk Kerkorian sold to Ted bought the property. He bought it in 1969. But MGM had five back lots. MGM had five lots, four of which were called back lots. And Kerkorian was selling off all the back lots to create condominiums. And he was going to use the funds from that to build his hotel in Las Vegas, the MGM Grand. And Derek knows knows this part of it very well, because he and Morgan White, his collaborator, uncovered some fantastic footage of the auction and the time when this whole property was being liquidated. And what that meant was everything had to be emptied out. And MGM hired an auctioneer by the name of David Weiss. And David Weiss was a furniture guy. He was a high-end furniture guy, and he was very interested in the antiques that were part of the MGM property. Louis B. Mayer used to buy. We used to go over to Europe and buy very expensive furniture during the Depression for outrageously low prices and use it in his movies. So there was all this great prop furniture, you know, to say nothing of two boats, the Showboat from Showboat, the paddle wheeler, the Bounty from the Mutiny on the Bounty was there. There were trains, there were cars, there were tanks, but there were also millions of costumes, literally millions of costumes. And David Weiss, the auctioneer, the essentially the liquidator, had no idea. He knew nothing about costumes. So he called a friend of his, a guy named Richard Carroll, who ran a clothing company in Beverly Hills called Carroll & Company, very high-end clothier. And he hired a young man named Kent Warner, who was an up-and-coming costumer. And Kent was an enormous movie fan. He was everything I wasn't. He loved movies, particularly the movies of the 20s and 30s. He loved the stars. But he had a real affinity for the costumes and understood what the costumes meant. And he is the one who set out on a search to find the ruby slippers at MGM. And it wasn't an easy search. He went hunting all over the back lots and finally got up into what appeared to be the top floor of an old barn. They called it Mr. Culver's Barn. Culver City in California was named after a farmer by the name of Culver. And the barn still stood, and that's where they stored a lot of the Oz stuff. And the reason they stored the Oz stuff was because it was so identifiable and so unique, it really had no use in any other films. Very few items from The Wizard of Oz ever got reused, and so they just got put into deep storage. And 30 years after the movie wrapped, a lot of this went into Culver's old barn, and Kent Warner went climbing through it and found all of the Oz stuff, including what remained of the pairs of ruby slippers. He took one pair and brought them to the auctioneer. Kent was a master of the half-truth. He took one pair and said, "Look what I found, the ruby slippers." And he gave them this pair for the auction. Well, they were in the worst condition. He kept all the other pairs for himself, including the wild Arabian-looking test pair. And now the story starts to unfold about what did Kent Warner do with the ruby slippers. And that was the secret that, you know, he took to his grave. That I was trying to unravel, and hence the chase. That I became obsessed with finding how many pairs of ruby slippers exist and where are they, and it took me all over the place. I ended up interviewing, I think, well over 200 people. Interviewed the surviving Munchkins. I interviewed Lorna Luft. I interviewed Liza. I interviewed. And Debbie Reynolds, who becomes a key player in the whole thing, unbeknownst to me. Although getting an interview from Debbie took a while. It took over a year. Her gatekeeper, her handler, Margie Duncan, a wonderful lady. But boy, was she tough. It was very, very, very hard to get through Margie. But finally I did. But each of the shoes, each pair of the shoes had its own story. That was the most unique thing to me and the shoes themselves were just sort of, they were props, but the story that went with each pair, really about people and how people behave, obsession. It was a story of real obsession, and It introduced me to a cast of characters, the likes of which I could have never imagined.
I am sure.
I like need this to be a movie.
I know.
Like, what is next for that?
Well, it became a movie.
I remember in Reese's book, I was 12. So, you know, a lot of it did go over my head a little bit, just because I was, you know, a child. But the pictures in the book, I remember when you put in pictures of the auction, I remember trying to look so closely, because this is the first time I'd ever seen photos of that, look so closely to see if I could recognize the other costumes. Mm-hmm. And that's when I began to really also, that obsession feeling, I sort of get, like wanting to see and wanting to touch and feel and be a part of that. I sort of understand that. I would not to the degree of like, you know, Kent, but maybe if the opportunity presented itself, it would have been different. Mm-hmm. Like,
well, and of course, just like any good story, any good mystery, you have to go back to the origins. You know, first I had to go back to 1938 and 1939 and try to figure out where the shoes actually came from. And then I had to go much more, which was much more fascinating, go back to the era of the MGM auction. And the MGM auction was like a 6-week wake for Hollywood. It was, right. On the one hand, it was fascinating. On the other hand, it was devastating. And I was 13 years old at the time of the auction. And all I remember about it was, you know, friends saying, hey, we can go down to this auction and buy some hippie clothes. We can get some, you know, suede fringe jackets, which, you know, that was the rage at the time. All anybody was thinking about was, you know, getting some really inexpensive, cool looking clothes. And that's where, you know, that's where the story really unfolds, is with the MGM auction of 1970.
Because like movie memorabilia wasn't quite yet a thing, or there wasn't like a world. It was like developing in these moments.
It movie memorabilia was nothing at the time. The studios were actively throwing away their history. And this shocked me, that the complete disregard for the, you know, MGM's was one thing, but then 20th Century Fox, Paramount, Warner Brothers, they were all throwing stuff away. And Kent Warner was shrewd enough to realize that these great iconic pieces of Hollywood memorabilia, pieces of Hollywood history, were being trashed. His introduction to this was earlier, and I believe it was about 1968, when Desi Lu, Lucille Ball's and Desi Arnaz's company, Desi Lu, bought the old RKO studios, basically buying the property so they could have a studio. And RKO is where a lot of the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies were made. And Kent Warner had come from New York to live in Hollywood and wanted to be a costumer. So he hired on at a company called Berman's, B-E-R-M-A-N-S. And they were in North Hollywood. And they basically went through, you know, whenever a studio was done with a picture or wanted to clear out some of its costume inventory, he would buy it up, you know, for pennies. And he was hired to go and help liquidate the costume department at RKO. And he sent Kent Warner over there, one of his young employees. And what Kent saw was a racks of clothing in the RKO commissary being used as rags. And he was shocked. He was shocked by this. And so he said, well, if they're just going to throw this stuff away, or even worse, use them as rags in a kitchen, I'm going to take them. And he did. And he started realizing that it wasn't just RKO, it was all the studios. And so he began systematically culling great pieces of Hollywood memorabilia from studios that didn't care about it. They were going to throw the stuff all away. And he got most of Ginger Rogers' gowns from the great films with Fred Astaire. He got, you know, several of Astaire's top hats and canes and bow ties as well, things like that. But he stretched out. He went over to 20th Century Fox and found some Marilyn Monroe gowns. He went to Warner Brothers and found some Humphrey Bogart, you know, things from Casablanca. He found the Maltese Falcon. I mean, he started he got his hands on just about everything. He had a partner by the name of Ron Wind, who was also, Ron had his own issues. Ron had a drug issue. And so the money that they got from pilfering these costumes and then selling them on the street, literally, Ron used for drugs. Kent used the money mostly to buy the things that he loved most, which were old radios and old televisions. He was a fanatic about that. Old Zippo lighters. He loved anything that was Art Deco, anything from the 20s and 30s. So he had this, built this cottage industry, and it culminated at MGM during the auction when he found the ruby slippers. And he wanted these things. He really cared about them. He wasn't just, you know, a common little petty thief. He wanted to preserve Hollywood's history. He imagined a Hollywood museum where all these things should be. And his hope for the pairs of ruby slippers that he found was that they would find good homes. They would end up in places where they would be cared for. And the one person he got to know during this whole time was Debbie Reynolds. Debbie was committed to preserving Hollywood's history. So committed that at the MGM auction, she was there every day. She told me she cried her eyes out at how it went. And she became determined to buy the props and costumes for a scene in every MGM movie that ever won an Oscar for Best Picture. And she sort of systematically started buying props, costumes, anything that her finances could afford. And she spent most of her fortune, most of all her money. In fact, she went into debt buying props and costumes at the MGM auction. But the one thing she did not buy, the one thing she did not even raise her hand during the auction, was the ruby slippers. And I thought that was peculiar. How come she didn't want the ruby slippers? How come she wanted everything else and spent all this money? Well, it turns out she had met Kent Warner. And Kent said that he thought there would be a way for her to get a pair of ruby slippers, one of the other pairs. And Debbie had famously said that the pair that were sold at auction, she said, I don't think they were Judy's pair. I think they were for the double. And that's a whole different story. And that's another, you know, can of worms. There are cans of worms all over this story. But
she tried them on. It's the same size as Judy's.
Well, it turns out Debbie was exaggerating a little about what size she wore and what size Judy wore. And, you know, I became, a shoe person. Like, now I'm studying shoes. But Debbie had made a deal. And through an intermediary, she was going to buy one of the pairs of ruby slippers from Kent for $2,500. And the intermediary was a guy named Michael Shaw. And Michael Shaw had also known Kent. They were sort of part of the same circle of individuals. Shaw took possession of the shoes, gave Kent $2,500, and then Michael kept the shoes. And, you know, possession, you know, it's who was going to say, you know, these are supposed to be for Debbie Reynolds, you know, when they had been lifted from MGM to begin with. And the auctioneer didn't even know about that they existed. And when Debbie found out, that was the end of her relationship with Michael Shaw. He was no longer in her employ. I think he was fine with that because he'd won the spoils. And Kent, in good faith, sold Debbie what's called the Arabian test pair, the pair of shoes that curl at the heels and toes. And those became that became Debbie's pair of ruby slippers. And to be honest, those are the most intriguing pair to me. They're the most fantastic looking, and they are truly unique. There's only one pair of those. But then that also, once Kent found out that the shoes didn't go to Debbie, that ended his relationship with Michael as well. Michael became a black sheep in the whole memorabilia underworld. And at this point, it's just an underworld. There's no, other than the MGM auction, there's nothing happening in the world of Hollywood memorabilia. And nothing really happens until 1988, when right after my first piece in the LA Times was published, the first Ruby Slippert piece. And like I said, every aspect of the story has all these little complications to it. Putting the book together became a challenge as to how to actually tell this story, which basically the LA Times piece was the scaffold for it. But with the book, I was able to get into much more detail and also write a few of those little mini biographies I wanted to write in tandem with the big bio of Kent Warner. And feel free to jump in and ask about any little part of it. And I'm sorry if I rattle on.
Yeah, we got you. Our hands are warming up here. Okay. We're going to get into all the various slippers that are now known, the ones that we know about. We'll talk about all the beautiful nicknames you gave them to that have kind of become Ruby Slipper lore now that we're obsessed with.
I should tell you, I had to do that because I had to find some way to keep the shoes different, distinct. So that's how I started naming them.
Oh, it's like now that's like a part of like...
Official.
Yes,
yeah. It's like so official.
It's
so
official.
Cool. Yes. It's so cool. Okay. We have to wander off. So we're loving this like underworld that's coming about. And like, we want to wander off down the false leads that you got, because I think the two of us loved talking the most about all the like false ones. Like these people saying they had slippers.
I have a pair in my basement.
Yes. And like refusing to show. And like, of course, Derek, we're going to get into this with you as well with the later on in like the 2016 timeframe. We'll get into that as well. Can you talk a little bit about some of the people you did connect with who said they had pairs or like heard of a pair and like any of those stories that still intrigue you or tickle you today?
Well, there were many what I called slipper sightings. There were, you know, people claim to have seen the slippers, you know, in Kansas City. They were in, you know, in San Diego. They were in San Francisco. They were all over here in Los Angeles. One of the first, you know, right from the beginning, when I originally made the first phone call to MGM, Sammy Davis Jr. said to have a pair. So through various circles, I happened to get to know his manager. And I asked Sammy's manager, I said, so Sammy, I've been told Sammy has a pair of Ruby slippers. And he says to me, no, he's actually only got one shoe. And I said, well, could you, you know, go next time you have a chance, could you go look at it and just tell me what it looks like? He said, oh, I've seen it. It's on a little plaque. And it was actually given to Liza Minnelli as one of the children of the original Oz characters. And he said, it's called the Ruby Slipper Award. And I thought, okay. So another of the people... So I don't know whether this is an actual shoe or whether it's some sort of replica,
right.
Because I'm now starting to learn about replicas as well.
Right.
So mm-hmm. I talked to Jack Haley Jr. Among many of my interviews, and Jack also had this exact same thing because he was given one of these as a child of one of the Oz principals. He said, oh yeah, that's the Ruby Slipper Award. That's a replica. You know, it was given to us, I can't remember the year, but it was given to us in commemoration of the film and of their parents. And he says, yeah, it's not real at all. And I thought, well, does Sammy know this? And so Sammy actually thought he had an authentic Ruby slipper. So I went back to his manager, and this is, Sammy is in poor health at this time. And I went back to his manager. I said, you know, I think that's a replica, but Sammy thinks it's real. Should we tell him? And we both decided, no, let's not tell him. And I can't say it's fortunate, but Sammy passed away before the publication of the story. May have been right about the same time as the LA Times piece. So we never told him. But I learned very quickly that there are a lot of false leads. There was a fellow in San Francisco by the name of Ted Smith who claimed to own a pair of Ruby slippers. And famously, advertised them in his, he had a novelty shop up in San Francisco, and he had them in the window as a draw to get people into his store. And he claimed that they were an authentic pair. Well, it turns out that that was not an authentic pair. It was a pair of fakes, which that would have been okay, except Ted ran into some money troubles, and he had the shoes insured, and he claimed that they were stolen, and then filed an insurance claim against the theft. Well, the San Francisco Police Department now gets involved, and they realize there was no theft, and Ted quickly withdraws the claim before he gets arrested for it. But he's unmasked as a fraud, and he duped a lot of people. He took in a lot of people, including a very prominent author by the name of Randy Schultz, who wrote the very first account of the AIDS epidemic, and The Band Plays On, where he identifies the so-called zero patient who had flown over from Africa or wherever. It turns out that there's been some revisionist history on that story as well. But nonetheless, Ted Smith had duped a lot of people. And the way he'd done it was his pair were pretty authentic, because he had contacted the lady in Tennessee, Roberta Bauman, who did own a pair of authentic shoes. And he asked her all kinds of very specific questions on the construction of the shoes. And based on her pair, he created a replica pair. And that was his fake pairs. What I realized was part of the reason there were so many slipper sightings around the country was because one of the pairs were traveling around. Michael Shaw began renting his shoes out to various places when they did Oz functions. And the shoes were a little cottage industry for him. He was able to, I think, make a little bit of money renting the shoes out here and there. And he'd rented them out to, he rented them out to some very good places. It was often children's hospitals, places where the shoes did some good. And I applaud Michael for that. He also took them up to Judy Garland's hometown, Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and loaned them up there. And of course, they become infamous up there in 2005. So the slipper sightings and the people who claim to have, I had to become very wary of it. I had a lot of people come up and, whisper to me, "I know where a pair of ruby slippers are." I was like, "Okay, tell me." I would say 95% of these slipper sightings were, dead ends, but I followed them. I, did my best. I also learned one of the more fascinating things I learned is that even someone like Steven Spielberg could get fooled by Hollywood, the land of Hollywood. He, at an auction, spent $60,000 for what he thought was the actual sled from Citizen Kane, the Rosebud. What he bought was one of a dozen balsa wood replicas that had been made for the film specifically for the burning scene. And so he bought a replica that had never been in the film, because if it had been in the film, it would have been burned, for $60,000. And the real Rosebud was still in the basement of the Herman and Joseph Mankiewicz family home in Beverly Hills, where their kids used to play with this sled, and it had Rosebud written on it. That was how, I can't remember if it was Herman or Joseph who wrote the screenplay, but that's how Rosebud came about. And even Spielberg was duped into buying a replica for a lot of money. And that story kind of humored me. But this is all my indoctrination into the weird world of Hollywood memorabilia.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And it's like you meet, I think, like all the characters who exist in The Wizard of Oz in a weird way. Like you meet the Wicked Witches, you meet the Good Witches, you meet the Scarecrows who get duped. Mm-hmm. You meet the people who do this because they have so much heart invested. You meet the people who are obsessed with the slippers because it empowers them. Like you meet literally all the people in Oz.
The parallels were striking.
Yes, right. And that's why Oz, I think, just lives on and on and on.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, okay, we love the back of your book has like the breakdown of all the slippers.
Oh, yeah.
There's the Bill Thomas mystery pair. Can you tell us a little bit about that? It's like, did he have a
Bill?
Bill was an interesting figure. He was a latecomer to the circle of friends of Kent Warner's. There were five individuals involved in this little gang. There was Kent. There was his partner, Ron Wind. There was Debbie. There was a fellow by the name of John LeBold. And then Bill Thomas came into the group through John. And what happened was, I've never quite figured it out completely. But for a time being, John had possession of Debbie's Arabian pair. And for a very short period of time, and then they went back to Debbie. But John, who also knew Kent very well, had told Bill that there might be pairs available. And Bill, at some point, I don't know when or where, but at some point he came to believe that he was going to get a pair. And then, in fact, he did get a pair. And this is what he told me, that he got a pair from Kent and that he had put them in a safe deposit box at the bank and he wouldn't look at them until he deserved to see them.
I'm obsessed with this story.
And when he told me this, I just had to roll my eyes like, what? Not until you deserve to see them? What do you have to do to deserve to see this prize piece of memorabilia? Well, Bill passed away in 1995. And when he passed away, there's been no word of this mystery pair of shoes. And allegedly, there had been up to seven pairs made for the film. If you look in the markings of all the shoes, you can see markings from 1 to 7 in various pairs. You know, pairs 3 and 4 are, you know, missing. I can't remember which the numbers were. But nonetheless, there are markings in all the shoes, including a naked pair that Michael also had. They had no overlays on them.
Is that the bugle bead pair?
No, it was. Okay. I think it was just a pair that had come from the Innes Shoe Company that had yet to get any sequined overlays, and were just a pair in waiting to get the overlays if they were needed, and then they were never needed. So the bugle bead pair are long gone. I think what happened to the bugle bead pair is they had bows added to them and became one of the continuity pairs. I think that's what became of them. Because the bugle bead pair, the only thing about the bugle bead pair, and for the life of me, I have no idea why I called them the bugle bead pair, except there were some bugle beads rimming. I think other than that, they're identical. And I think they just had bows added to them and became continuity pairs.
Means that there's four known out of the seven
four known continuity pairs. And one known test pair, the Arabian test shoes.
So before we get now the slippers documentary tied on into all of this. So I am an 80s baby. I was born late 80s. And I really am glad my parents gave birth to me when they did, because it was in this like Oz renaissance. I'm like, thank you so much. And when all this stuff was coming out, which was so great. What was it like to release the Ruby Slippers of Oz amidst like this whole renaissance of Oz, 50th anniversary celebration? Who did you get to meet? Like what new characters stumbled across your path? Anything that you want to share there?
When the articles were first published in the LA Times, they were a big hit. It was a 20,000 word piece, which at the time was the longest piece that had ever been published in the LA Times. And it was published over 2 consecutive weeks in the calendar section, the once great LA Times calendar section that is now a mere shadow of itself. In fact, it's barely even an ash from the shadow. It's very sad what's become of calendar. But uh, But it, the, you know, the most prominent thing that happened was, you know, I'd said that it took me a long time to talk to Debbie, and it did. It took me well over a year to get an interview with her and to talk about the Michael Shaw situation, to talk about Kent. And she was very reserved. It was a funny interview because she called me at about midnight one night and she was sloshed. She'd obviously had a lot of champagne. So it was kind of a funny interview, but she would not say an ill word about anybody. All she would say is that, collectors of Hollywood memorabilia are obsessive people and it's a weird obsession. She didn't really want to talk about Kent. And she definitely didn't want to talk about Michael, but she did talk about the shoes and her own obsession with getting various, pieces of memorabilia. I shouldn't say various, like hoarding. And she would talk. She did talk about that she owned the Arabian pair, but that's the only pair she owned. She said she didn't own any other pair. And that was about as much as she would tell me, and I had to ferret out the rest from people who knew Kent and people who knew Michael. And I met her at a party. I think it was the St. James Club on Sunset. And it was a party, had nothing to do with the stories. It was just a Hollywood party, and I knew Debbie was going to be there. And I went up and introduced myself to her. And she was very polite. But the one thing she said to me was, I didn't like everything you wrote about me, but you were fair. So that was a very good thing. And then probably 10 years later, I'm working at a little documentary production company called Greystone Television. And we were on the ground floor of the History Channel, well, of A&E, because A&E was before History. But we were on the ground floor of A&E and History. And I wrote over 100 shows for A&E and History during this period. In 1998, we had a little series called Treasure. And I had written the pilot episode on a Spanish galleon by the name of the Atocha that had sunk off the Florida Keys in the 16th century and had been discovered in the 20th century by the famous treasure hunter Mel Fisher. But then we did a whole series of shows kind of like this, and we came to the end of our series, show number 13, and the show wasn't going to be renewed. The series wasn't going to be renewed. It sort of ran its course, mostly because we were running out of subjects. And my boss at Greystone said, well, how about we do one on the slippers? And I said, oh, well, sure. I know that story. I can easily do that. The search for the ruby slippers. And that was part of the A&E treasure series. And at that time I thought, well, I want to photograph everything. We contacted all the principals, everyone who had the shoes. Michael, of course, turned me down. He wouldn't want to have anything to do with me, threatened to sue, like he always did. And, but I called up Margie Duncan at Debbie's shop, and asked Margie if Debbie would agree to an interview and let me photograph her Arabian pair. 2 minutes later, Debbie says yes. So I spent over a year trying to get her on the phone to talk to her initially, but because I had met her and she believed in what I was doing, she was very thankful that I'd written about Kent, especially in the book. And she was very forthcoming. She agreed to the interview. We did the interview. She brought the shoes over. We photographed them. The photo that's on the back of the new book of the Arabian pair is one of the photos I took of those shoes. And she was, at this point, she said, well, Kent's gone. I feel like I can talk about him now. And that's when she opened up and told me much more of the story. And she did not want to get into a little cat fight with Michael about what happened there, but she made it pretty clear of what had transpired. And she said, he knows what happened. I know what happened. And that's the way it is. So I did. I also, at that same party that I met Debbie, I met a woman by the name of Ricky Roberts, whose mother had been a costumer at MGM. And she had this sort of weaselly husband who starts getting in my ear saying that they have a pair of the shoes. They also have a pair, but they're not telling anybody where they are, and they're not going to, they're not going to tell me anything about it, just that they have a pair. And he said the reason they have a pair was because when Kent found them originally at MGM, a couple of the other customers knew, and they had to, they were given as part of a payoff for their silence to not tell the auctioneers that there was more than one pair. So it was a plausible story. And I began chasing down that story, and it just never panned out. Although there's a fellow right now who is a ruby slipper guy, Randy Struthers. I don't know if you know Randy. Okay. Randy is convinced that Ricky Roberts really did get a pair as part of this hush pair. I guess a hush money hush pair. And he is convinced that he has the evidence to prove it now. The only problem is there's no shoes. You know, we haven't seen another pair of shoes crop up. So until I see a pair of shoes that, you know, tell me, yes, this is pair number five, I'm going to be skeptical on that. But so the consequence of the publication of the stories did open up a lot of avenues. I also learned the identity of the fellow who had donated the shoes to the Smithsonian, which up until then had been kept secret. And I learned about it very much by accident. One of my associates on the documentary for A&E had called up the Smithsonian because we needed to get permission to film the shoes there, and whoever they talked to went and looked in the file and told her the name of the person who had donated them. Just blurted it out, and he was a fellow here in L.A., a kind of a high-powered lawyer who had bought them at the MGM auction, thinking they were the one and only pair of ruby slippers. And he got them for his kids. And I called him up, and he confirmed everything. He said he agreed to it. And I sent him a copy of the book, and he later said, yep, that's pretty. I'd made a guess that the anonymous buyer at the MGM auction had donated them to the Smithsonian, that at first had gotten really pissed when he found out there was more than one pair. And that's an interesting story in itself, how that news transpired. And that because of that, he made a donation to the Smithsonian for what he said was a sizable tax deduction. Now the way he found out that there was more than one pair of ruby slippers was because of this little old lady in Tennessee. On the morning after the ruby slippers at the MGM auction sold for $15,000, which was an astronomical price. The blurb in the auction catalog is one sentence. There's no picture. It's just, you know, a pair of Judy Garland's ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz. That was it. And they sold for $15,000. It was astonishing. Apparently was a tremendous hush in the auction area when these slippers sold for so much.
I was actually just going to say, do you think Judy's death had something to do too with the allure of the slippers as well in 1970? No?
I think yes. I do think that I think it's a combination of things. You know, when one of the things in the memorabilia world is when you have a prop and a star and a film all come together, that creates the magic of value. And in the case of, you know, Judy Garland was a tragic figure, but also an enigmatic figure, much like Marilyn and Elvis. Those are sort of the big three. Steve McQueen has sort of ascended into that area now. James Dean is sort of there. But definitely the allure of the combination of Judy Garland, The Wizard of Oz, and the shoes themselves. And the fact that The Wizard of Oz is America's really one and only original fairy tale. It's really the only one we have that identifies so strongly with what you could say American values are. So, and this links back to this wonderful lady in Memphis, Tennessee, Roberta Bauman, in 1939, entered a movie contest sponsored by MGM to name the 10 best pictures of the year. And so she named, her favorite movie was Gone with the Wind, so that was number one. And her second favorite movie was The Wizard of Oz, so that was number two. And she won second prize in this contest. And her first place won The Gavel from Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Jimmy Stewart's film. Nobody knows where that gavel is anymore, because it probably got reused and used and broken. Who knows? But as second prize, she won a pair of ruby slippers. And she thought that was terrific. And, you know, they were presented to her in her little English class in February of 1940. And she was 16 years old. She was the same age as Judy Garland and allegedly Dorothy in the film. And so Roberta Bauman was like Dorothy. And she got these shoes when she's 16 years old. And shows them around, takes them to the local library and everything. And then World War II happens and people forget about, you know, things like movie props. She stuck them in her closet and life went on. She got married. She had kids. And every year or so when Wizard of Oz would appear on television on CBS, she would take the shoes down to their local library and put them on display for a day or two so other kids could see them. But she pretty much just forgot about them. Then on the morning after the MGM auction sale, where the shoes went for $15,000, she's reading in her little, the Memphis Appeal, I believe it is, in her local newspaper, ruby slippers sell for $15,000 at MGM auction. And she's saying, what? How could they sell the ruby slippers? I have them in my closet. And she called up the paper and said, how could they have sold the ruby slippers when I have them? And she said, I was told these were the real pair. And sure enough, they were real. So her story then goes out on the wire. The paper publishes a picture of her with her shoes. Her story goes out on the wire. And then the man who purchased the shoes at the MGM auction sees her picture and her story in the paper and says, wait, I just paid $15,000. What for? Are they even real? So now both Roberta Bauman and the man who bought them at the auction are thinking, who's got the fakes? You know, which one are real? Which pair are real? Which pair are fakes? Roberta wrote a letter to MGM trying to get an answer. The anonymous buyer wrote a letter to David Weiss, the auctioneer, trying to get an answer. And Weiss wrote a letter back to him, which this guy shared with me, saying, these are the true one and only pair. So David Weiss didn't even know. He was duped. Roberta never got an answer from MGM. Her letters were returned unopened. But the only person who knew at the time what the real story was Kent Warner. And so that's kind of, you know, how the reactions went. And I know when my stories were published, people were shocked. People were surprised that there was more than one pair. So hence, more complications.
So yes. Complex.
I love it.
Always ever evolving.
Yes.
Why don't we, this is amazing. We're going to keep breaking down the slippers as we're going. And now we want to get Reese, your work led to Derek doing his work. And also the A&E documentary too, that happened prior to the slippers documentary.
Let me tell you a little story. I got a lot of inquiries on the shoes, people who wanted to, you know, the story was optioned a couple of times. And people, you know, always, you know, I would always get sort of a lot of crank calls about people who want to do this or do that. Or, you know, I eventually started using a moniker to avoid the many weird crank calls I would get. But I got this call from a guy named Morgan White. And Morgan had this dream of making a movie with his friend Derek, Lajeunesse. and I was very skeptical, as I was with everything. I thought, well, you know what? I want to see how sincere these guys are. I said, well, what, you know, if you, let's talk about it. Why don't you come out to California? Let's meet and let's see if this is something that we can work out. And they showed up and we went out to dinner at La Dolce Vita, sat in one of the red leather booths, and I became extremely impressed by their sincerity and their desire to make a really good film. And plus, they had the chops to do it. I could tell that they were professionals. They knew what they were doing. They were hooked up with a good company. And so I said, sure, I'll participate. Derek, lead the way. What's your recollection of that?
We have to say that your documentary inspired so much of why we're even podcasting.
I have chills. It's like,
yeah, it's just like, it's all passing down. Because like we just got so wrapped up and intrigued and like, this is all rabbit holes. Like everything we're sharing today is like we're falling down another rabbit hole about this kind of a human being who's existing in this world. Mm-hmm. And they're attracted to the shoes for this reason.
And,
this
and I should say, there's no way out. Once you climb there's into the rabbit hole, there's no way out.
No. Yeah.
You're there.
And this really, really inspired us to start our podcast. So it's just kind of a cool full circle, weird full circle moment, but also very, very inspiring and cool. All right, Derek, come at us with, tell us how the documentary, like how it started, what was the hope, the aim initially to unveil?
Well, the starting point is, of course, Reese's book. Like for me, that was the text of like the behind the scenes movie stuff for me for many years. And Morgan and I met in college in 2006. We were in the post-production program at a place called Humber College in Toronto. And he and I became friendly and we just had a mutual, he loves movies. He's much more of the classic, not classic Hollywood person. That's more me. He's more like Star Wars and Indiana Jones and that he's that kind of movie guy. Whereas I'm more in the Kent movie guy kind of world, but we had a mutual, you know, affection for film. And he was asking me about behind the scenes movie books. I'm like, well, the definitive text of like a behind the scenes movie memorabilia is Reese's book. So I lent it to him and he read it and he was of course fascinated. Mostly because Reese can weave an amazing yarn. And to weave all of these threads together is actually an amazing accomplishment. And we were so, that was the biggest challenge of the movie itself when we actually made the film was like, we had so much interview footage and we had so many threads to follow. And we didn't use a narrator in the movie, except for Reese. Reese becomes the foundationary interview of the film. Because as you've heard in this podcast so far, he can have a beginning, middle, and end to a story which actually edits together beautifully and was able to illustrate, able to verbally, you know, sort of convey what we wanted to illustrate visually with some pretty amazing footage that we were able to track down. So none of this would have happened without Morgan. Morgan is extremely ambitious and he's a go-getter. And whereas I'm a Gen X, Morgan is a millennial and there's a bit of a difference. I find Morgan's probably, he's about 7 or 8 years younger than me, but there's something Morgan has no, it's not like he doesn't take no for an answer, but I'm sure Reese, you can attest to this. His confidence in asking, people have a hard time saying no. So he instills some sort of confidence. And when he was like, do you want to go to LA? And it was February 2014. And he's like, we're going to talk to Reese. I'm like, really? I was like, okay, let's do this. So Morgan was sort of like the administration and the head, whereas I was the heart and the fan of this. So it was always understood Morgan was going to be the guiding force, mostly because it was the main part of his job where we worked, whereas I was still working on other shows. So I knew that my editing role, The Slippers, would come a year later. I edited the movie in the summer of 2015 up until about Christmas time. It was sort of on and off for 6 months. But we shot most of it in 2014. And it's amazing to me how it's instantly dated because more stuff happens with the shoes. Reese can attest to this too, right? You could probably publish another version of your book every 5 years and have more, like more to put in it. Cause even more has happened this year. Like it's constantly evolving and changing. So our main goal was to present visually what Rees presented through his book. That was our main goal, and it was difficult.
Speaking of visuals, I should note that when they showed up, Morgan was carrying a copy of my book that was so tattered you could barely see the cover. It was so tattered. The pages scuffed. Were all, it was, I think the first thing I said was, I got to get you another copy of the book.
You did say that. You did. Because he had my copy from 89. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Morgan, no, you're being too rough with it. Buy your own. So, because mine is in this black cabinet here with my 12-year-old handwriting in it. But he bought his own, which he roughed up, and because he read it like, you know, inside and out, just to start. And he is very investigative, and so he mostly was able to secure a lot of interviews, and we were able to like uncover the story slowly, 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 sort of. Building on what Rees did, but using Rees as, of course, the ultimate resource of all of this. So our goal was to make something also visually interesting. We ran into some problems in post-production because of copyright issues. So that was a bit of an issue. So we had to recut. Yes.
Every single one has
Warner Brothers, which had acquired the property, was extremely litigious. And
yes,
if you whispered the word Oz, you got a letter from their lawyers. So
yes, no, yeah, I had several cuts of the film, and a lot of things did have to get trimmed down. And like even after I left the film, Morgan had to go in, and he has a little bit of experience editing too, and he had to recut some parts. So you know, it was the kind of thing that was very much it was affected a little bit in post. But I was really happy when I first saw it. When I saw it 6 months later. I was really happy with it. But I don't know where I was going with that. But we were sort of in the world of, we were also like Rees was saying, for the moments when it was being made, we were sort of dragged into this world too, because we were in one of the most memorable afternoons of my life. It was being in Michael Shaw's apartment. And I think that was the day after we met Rees at the restaurant. Mm-hmm. So we had, or was it after we interviewed you, something like that. I'm not sure of the timeline of it all, but it was around the time. And you were like, check out his replicas, make sure they're actually replicas.
This is after the theft.
Yes. So we're in this window of, we don't know who it is. And you knew, we intellectually knew he wouldn't have the shoes out.
And he wouldn't let you, he wouldn't let you photograph them.
No. I was able to take pictures of other things, mm-hmm. but the shoes I was not allowed to take a photograph of.
Suspicious.
He also has 1989 replicas. Is that what you're talking about?
This is what happened. In 2005, the shoes are stolen from the museum.
Right.
Shortly before that theft, you know, in all my research, one of the things that I had to figure out was what's a real pair, you know, which led me into the world of replicas. And so I got to know several of the real good replica makers. And one of them had told me that he had made a pair of replicas for Michael based on Michael's shoes, photographs he had taken of them on one of their journeys, and that Michael had paid him X amount for this pair of replicas, which he came into possession sometime either right before or right after the theft. So that's the issue with this particular instance, and why I was so interested in having Derek and Morgan photograph Michael's shoes, because they were going to interview him. Michael, you know, Michael won't talk to me anymore. He hasn't talked to me since 1988. But I was... I was wondering, you know, if they were his actual real pair and a pair of replicas had actually been stolen, or, you know, if these were replicas that he had, you know, exact replicas, and the real ones, you know, who knew where the real ones were. But anyhow, I was very interested in that and was disappointed that you couldn't photograph them. I remember that.
Yeah. Michael told me that they are replicas, and I looked at them, and they didn't seem, because I had seen, the only shoes I've ever seen are the Smithsonian pair, mm-hmm. the people's shoes, and they didn't seem as old as that. They didn't seem as they didn't reek authentically to me just upon glance.
Right.
But then again, the stuff in his apartment didn't look as old as I thought it would either. There was a, he had a Dorothy dress, which you can see in our documentary, that was just out, and it looked really good. Like, it looked pretty new. The white was very white on the blouse, mm-hmm. and it looked
this
pretty good.
Living room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was
It was more like a mausoleum.
It was a strange place.
Dark downstairs. No, all the windows covered up. It was.
Yeah. And really packed.
Yes.
Like packed. And every table, every surface, everywhere had something on it. Like, we went into his bedroom and he had the portrait of Laura from the movie Laura from the 40s. He had some T-Bird leather jackets from the movie Grease, mm-hmm. beside Edith Head's Academy Awards. And there was all this, it was just, he was living amongst it. It was very interesting.
I know. That's an interesting experience.
I'm going to have a cup of coffee next to this Academy.
I would be nervous. Thing. Yeah, spilling.
A little bit, yeah. And he also had antiquities and things like that. So it wasn't just movies. It was mostly movie stuff. But he also said he had this is Abraham Lincoln's signature. He had a picture from the Titanic, the New York Times of the Titanic sinking, a newspaper. Lots of amazing stuff. The tablets from the Ten Commandments and... from the movie, not...
Yeah. Not the actual. Not from the actual. At this point, I don't know.
Yeah, he got him. He has right. connection.
Yeah.
He got him. But for that brief moment, we were sort of Reese had told us, you become part of the story too. They overtake you. And that's what was happening to us too. We were in it. So it was very interesting because it was that little window of time when the shoes were still missing. So yeah, things were sort of up in the air. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Fascinating. Why don't we, between the two of you now, because I'm sure interviews that you had on the documentary and recent interviews you had for the book are going to come on up. Talk about the different pairs. We've kind of mentioned different pairs as we've been going along. Mm-hmm. And also maybe if you would re-nickname them today, because obviously the traveling shoes are Michael Shaw's shoes, the ones that have kind of the most seedy origin story of did he take these from Debbie Reynolds?
Right.
They have been the most,
notorious. I would say notorious.
Yeah. They have had the strangest existence. They have had their own life of their own for almost 15 years.
Each,
no one knows.
Each pair has a life. I'll give you a real quick rundown. We'll start with the people's shoes. The people's shoes are called the people's shoes because they're at the Smithsonian. They were the pair sold at the MGM auction in May of 1970. They were donated to the Smithsonian in 1979, and they have been there ever since. They occasionally go off public display, but for the most part, they're on perpetual display, and they are, next to the Spirit of St. Louis, the most popular item that people visit at the Smithsonian Institution of all the museums. They are and I have a feeling they have surpassed the Spirit of St. Louis today because their lore just keeps growing and growing. The next pair are what I referred to as the traveling shoes. And this is the pair that were supposed to go to Debbie Reynolds, but ended up with Michael Shaw. So this pair was initially taken from MGM by Kent Warner, surreptitiously. Liberated is the word I like to use. And then they were liberated from Debbie by Michael. And then they were liberated from Michael by what appears to be a band of thieves. And so I, for the revision, the Ruby Slippers of Oz 30 years later, which came out a couple of years ago, I have renamed those shoes the Stolen Shoes because they have been stolen now several times.
Yes.
There are Dorothy's shoes, and Dorothy's shoes are that pair of shoes that the nice little woman in Memphis, Tennessee got as a prize in 1940. And I named them Dorothy shoes simply because Roberta Bauman was so much like a Dorothy character. right down to her homespun manners and just wonderful disposition. She used to love corresponding with me and with others about the shoes from her kitchen table, her little portable typewriter, a manual typewriter, and I still have many of her typewritten letters. And so that's Dorothy's shoes. Those shoes were sold at Christie's in Christie's East in 1988, and this was an astounding sale. She wanted $15,000 for them. She felt that since the pair sold in 1970 for $15,000, her pair should be worth $15,000 in 1988. Well, they sold for $165,000, which set a record immediately for Hollywood memorabilia and really launched the what I would say is the beginning of the Hollywood memorabilia craze. That was the opening salvo of people really realizing, oh, this stuff has value. We should be keeping it. And then finally, there are the witch's shoes. And the witch's shoes are the pair that Kent Warner kept for himself. They are the pairs all have various identifying marks on them. The most distinct identifying mark on three of the pairs is they have orange felt on the bottoms of the shoe and the heel, little bits of orange felt. And the reason I surmised is because Dorothy, Judy Garland, was walking along and dancing along a Hollywood yellow brick road, which was not made of gold bricks, but in fact was made of plywood. And the shoes made a clacking noise, a clattering clacking noise on the plywood, so they muffled them. So all the pairs that have orange felt on them were probably the wide shot, medium shot, dancing shoes, walking shoes, everything on the yellow brick road. But one pair does not have orange felt on the bottom, and those are the close-up shoes. The shoes used to click your heels three times, and the witch's fingers. And because of that, I decided to name them the witch's shoes. Because they were the close-up pair and in the best condition. They'd probably only been worn a couple of times, specifically preserved for, you know, the scene on the witch's feet, the squished Wicked Witch of the East. They're there. Mm-hmm. And then they are on the two famous close-up shots in the movie and probably not used anywhere else. The interesting thing about that is I've always wondered if Judy Garland actually wore those shoes when they were making those shots, because if you didn't need to see Judy Garland, then have their stand-in put her feet in those for those shots. You don't need Judy on the set. You just get Bobby Cochet, who was her stand-in, who incidentally had the exact same size foot. They wore the same size shoe. So when people say, oh, the stand-in shoes were bigger, well, Judy wore a 6.5 through most of her adult life. So there's that. Kent Warner sold those shoes at auction. He tried to sell them in 1980, and this is when he's starting to get sick. He wanted $20,000 or $25,000, and he tried to sell them at a local auction in LA, and they didn't sell. And so he took them to Christie's East, and in 1981, that pair sold for $12,000. After Roberta sold hers in 88, the Dorothy shoes, for $165,000, the underbidder was contacted, or the person who bought the pair from Kent Warner's sale at Christie's East in 81, contacted Christie's and said, do you think an underbidder would be interested in another pair? And so they contacted the underbidder, who was a fellow by the name of Philip Samuels, who agreed to pay the same price, $165,000. So actually, two pairs of ruby slippers were sold within a month for the same price in 1988 through Christie's East, and I'm sure they were thrilled by that. Dorothy's pair then resold in 2000 for $666,000 to a consortium of buyers, mostly Los Angeles-related people. I referred to them as flying monkeys because they really stole the pair at that price. And I thought the price was significant. It was kind of telling, $666,000. Then Philip Samuels kept the witch's shoes. And I've always believed that pair is cursed. And Philip Samuel's wife actually had a cleansing with that pair after she, you know, found out about my feelings about them being cursed. And I felt that they were cursed because first, Judy Garland had a tragic death. Kent Warner had a tragic death. And then when I filmed them in St. Louis in 1998 for the A&E documentary, my photographer, brilliant photographer by the name of Garrett Lakin, who I'd worked with on a number of different documentaries, historical stuff, mostly for History and A&E, he died of a heroin overdose about less than a year after we shot those shoes in St. Louis. And so that's the pair. I will not touch them. I actually have never touched a pair of ruby slippers. They kind of give me the creeps. But that pair in particular are cursed. Philip Samuels put them up for auction in 2010, and wanted $2 million. And it didn't pass. They did not sell, but then they were privately, after there was no sale, a deal was privately negotiated between what are called the angel donors, Steven Spielberg, Leo DiCaprio, and a Hollywood executive by the name of Terry Semel, who all paid $2 million and then donated the pair to the Academy of Motion Pictures and Arts and Sciences, the Oscar people. And so those shoes are now at the Motion Picture Academy Museum, the new museum that's opened up, and are on perpetual display. So we've got two pairs on perpetual display, the Smithsonian pair and the pair at the Academy. Dorothy's shoes.
They're actually not, Reese.
Oh, are they not?
I was there in December, and they'd replaced that with a Godfather exhibit, and the worker at the museum said that they're not going to keep them on all the time.
Which museum?
This is what he told me.
Which museum?
This is the Academy.
The Academy.
Yes, in L.A. I was really disappointed.
Yeah, they're very strange about them. In any event, those are – we know the homes of those. The Dorothy's pair, the ones that were this swept away by the flying monkeys, we haven't seen those since they were at the auction in 2000. Morgan and Derek offered to pay the fellow who allegedly has them, and I think they're really owned by somebody else, but offered to pay him. And at first he said yes, and then he said no. Yeah. And Derek can tell that story. Wild. Yeah. And then
Morgan offered me. Yeah, go on, Reese.
And then there, well, you know what? You better tell that story before I dive into the stolen.
Okay. They basically... Elkaby. Yeah. He owns like a gift shop on Hollywood Boulevard, which sort of is what you exactly would imagine it would be. He said to Morgan, they were filming that day, and he said, you can see them, but it'll cost you $2,500, and I can bring you to the site where they're kept. And Morgan was like, yes, let's do it. He's like, it's part of the film's budget. This is amazing. Of course we'll do it. But then he sort of, the next day he reneged. He sort of fobbed Morgan off a little bit, and he sort of just, and that never happened. But Morgan tried. And he, you know, $2,500 is a lot of money, but in a film's budget, it would be an essential piece to it. So it just made us think, why wouldn't he do it?
David Elkaby is sort of a shifty character to begin with. He had previous legal issues with the law regarding what was allegedly fraudulent memorabilia, and had he's definitely a sketchy character. Now let's get to the big pair, the current big pair. We know exactly where they are right now. They're in the hands of the FBI. They're being held as evidence in the case of the stolen ruby slippers. And this pair originally came from Kent Warner from MGM. He spirited them away, probably in a duffel bag. They were supposed to go to Debbie Reynolds, but they went to Michael Shaw. Michael Shaw took them and did some good things with them, traveling them around the country, showing them off. They were probably, other than the Smithsonian pair, probably the most seen pair out there. And then on the night of August 28th, 2005, they're stolen. Mysteriously so. A very quick break-in, that little plexiglass case they were in got smashed and the shoes vanished. And it would have been a big story, except for something else happening in the United States that same night. Hurricane Katrina smashed into New Orleans. And Hurricane Katrina consumed all the airwaves. And so this story about this pair of stolen ruby slippers just kind of sat there and began simmering. And it simmered and it simmered and it simmered. And then just before Labor Day in 2018, on a Friday afternoon, I get a phone call. And I'm not home, so it's a message on my answering machine from a fellow identifying himself as a representative of the FBI. He said his name was Michael Kolstad. And would I be available to come up to Minneapolis on Tuesday? This is Tuesday after Labor Day. And it's a Friday. And it's like, I'm thinking, this is kind of weird. What's this about? And he said, it's about the ruby slippers. We have recovered the ruby slippers. And I thought at that moment, okay, well, I don't really have a choice, do I? I have to go up to Minneapolis.
I'm in the rabbit hole.
And I actually had some pretty serious health issue going on. So I had a doctor's appointment that I had to attend on the Wednesday. They were going to do the big reveal on a Tuesday, and I had to be home by that Wednesday. So I flew up on a Monday. I went to the unveiling of the shoes they had recovered on Tuesday, heard the press conference, and then flew home that night to make my appointment on Wednesday. But during that trip, I was able to speak with not just Michael Kolstad, who sort of was my chaperone, but I got to speak with the two special agents in charge of the investigation. And they picked my brain a bit. I tried to pick theirs. I wasn't very successful at that. But I did manage to establish a rapport to which I'm still in contact with them. And they do try to keep me up to date, but not very much. But nonetheless, I got an insight into their investigation. They showed me some photographs that they were hoping I might be able to help them identify, and told me the basics of what had happened and how the shoes had been the center of an extortion scheme where the people who had stolen them had wanted to sell them back, literally sell them back to the insurance company that had paid Michael off for the theft of the shoes. He had them insured for $1 million, and they paid him, I think, about $860,000, with apparently a clause saying he has first right to buy them back. Although people I've talked to in the insurance business and in the appraisers world say they've never heard of such a clause. But in any event, the FBI will keep the shoes until the case is completely closed. And it was, I believe, a little over a month ago that an arrest was made. A fellow by the name of Terry John Martin, an older fellow, 76 years old, had been arrested in the theft, and he was local to Grand Rapids, Minnesota. He'd apparently been involved some like 20 years ago in thefts of some furs. So he had a bit of a record as a sort of an alleged petty thief of some kind. But nonetheless, this is an unfolding story. These guys are, you know, my most recent communication with the FBI was, it's ongoing. We have an arrest. We've got a trial date set. And at the trial, we're going to find out how many other people are involved. I know that the recovery of the shoes was negotiated by an attorney out of Florida who had been involved in some other high profile, thefts. So, and then there's have you read the Washington Post piece, the Washington Magazine piece by Emily, I believe it's Emily Evett Dickinson? It's magnificent. If you Google who stole the ruby slippers, it'll come up with the Washington Magazine story, and it's fantastic. She took the ball and ran with it like much further than I ever did. I'll be very honest. By this stage of the whole story, I'm worn out. It's tough to keep tabs on all of it. At some point, I have to pass the torch. And Emily was she like a good Olympic runner. She grabbed it and ran with it and wrote a great story, which uncovers a lot of the mystery of what happened. But we still don't know. And I have a feeling that we've just seen the tip of the iceberg on it. We're going to find out a lot more about the gang who stole the ruby slippers.
Because the trial's in August, I think.
Is it in August?
I think it starts next month. Yeah. I read that. It might not be right, but yeah.
Well, and you never know. As we've seen with the imperious orange-haired golf cheater and occupant, former occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Right.
Trials can be delayed a long, long time. So we don't know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, thank you for breaking down each of those pairs. I know, obviously.
It's exhaustive.
And the Arabian test pair. I forgot them.
Oh, yes.
The Arabian test pair, Debbie Reynolds kept them until she finally had to sell her collection as part of a bankruptcy order, and which she sold her Dorothy dress. And the Arabian test pair sold for, I think they were well over $1 million, to a Saudi, a mysterious Saudi buyer. So they are now somewhere in the Middle East, and that's all we know about them.
That pair is fascinating to me.
I'm devastated. I never saw those.
It would be so cool if we could see them. Well, thank you for recounting that. I will say I have a Google Doc where I have kept meticulous tracking from both. So I owe both of you to everything you've already documented. Thank you so much for continuing.
We got the torches
for you. So we're gonna start wrapping up with a lightning round of just some kind of fun questions to lead us to the end.
Okay, which one is your favorite slipper out of these, out of Dorothy Arabian pair, out of the collection, out of the five?
Well, go ahead, Derek.
I think my favorite pair, even though they're the most interesting pair are Kent's pair, the witch's shoes, because of what Reese talked about. There's a dark element to them. And I tend to think of Oz and my experience with Oz as something sort of mysterious and something I don't understand that can be dark, but can also be happy. And I really identify with Kent and his love of old movies. And Kent's journey, I feel, is something that, had I been there at the same time, I probably would have taken as well. Like, I understand these feelings. I feel like I have a kinship to him. And that's why I like to thank Reese for bringing Kent into the light more, because his shoes, I feel, are the most emotionally important, even if they are the darkest. But that's maybe part of the layers of the story and our relationship with childhood. Because these movies, these shoes often represent pieces of childhood, which as we get further away from childhood, it's amazing what sort of sticks and how a piece of a flicker of light can elicit such feelings from us still to this day, because it's a tangible representation of a time that's gone for us. And what do we have to hang on to? So I identify with those the most.
Aesthetically, I like the Arabian pair. They're the most unique. They were Debbie's favorite pair. And I find them to be, I have touched that pair, photographed them in total, and I just like the looks of them. Sentimentally, Dorothy's pair, because of Roberta Bauman. She was such a wonderful lady, and I was very thankful I got to know Roberta. And so those are probably my favorites.
Those are the first ones I saw at the Great Movie Ride when they were there in like the early 90s. Yes. And like, I also love Anthony Landini's
Anthony
story.
Landini, Disney World.
Sweet. Yeah. And it bums me out that those shoes are now, and they were with Good Witches
out
for
of
a
all
while.
The pairs, that breaks my heart. Yeah, that pair specifically is just locked away currently.
So. Well, he got a handsome return on his money.
Yes, he did.
Anthony like came out of all this.
Yeah, he came out. He
like really,
so did Roberta.
And I love their friendship.
And he did good by them. He arranged for the deal at Disney where they could be seen and where they could also be protected, because he knew that he couldn't adequately protect them. So
smart. Yeah. yeah, I respect what he did so much. Mm-hmm. Our second lightning round question, this could be personal or professional. Where is your yellow brick road taking you these days?
Well, this is interesting because, you know, most of my adult life, Wizard of Oz has been there and but it's sort of been backburnered with life stuff, you know, like it came to a head in 2015, 2016, when we made the slippers, when I was able to merge these two worlds. But now as I work away, I'm working on home renovation TV shows and things like that. So there's really no connection to old Hollywood or Judy Garland or Oz. So, you know, this world of podcasting, you know, the way you guys feel inspired by the documentary, which was inspired by Reese, I am in turn inspired by you guys to create something authentically, which I love talking about, which is Judy Garland. So, and movie history and the studio system. I think that's such an amazing moment in time that people don't really understand enough of. So I am hoping my yellow brick road leads to the creation of a podcast, which I've been working on the past few months, about Judy Garland and about MGM and her time there and the good, the bad, the ugly, very, very ugly, but also very amazing time that she had there. So that's where I hope my yellow brick road is going, and always towards something better. Like, I'm not generally an optimistic person, but I want to be. I want to believe in what's at the end. And hopefully it's better than, you know, I expect. I don't know.
Maybe it'll be an F. Scott Fitzgerald script that was supposed to be at the end. Maybe
folded in half and stuffed into the side.
Yes, stuffed in a box.
Librarian smoking a cigarette.
I can't get over that.
Like, whatever.
Oh, my gosh. We can't wait for your podcast.
My yellow brick road led me into more television production. More actually, first it took me to Fox, where I ended up on the ground floor of what became Fox News. And at the time, it was going to be a 5-minute Fox. It wasn't even a network yet. It was sort of a satellite network. And we literally put 5 minutes of, we were called Fox Entertainment News. We were the brainchild of the Fox chairman at the time, Barry Diller. I should say Fox president, because Rupert was still chairman. And my favorite story from those days is that we were a very liberal, very left-winging, muckraking crew at Fox Entertainment News. Barry Diller, who was the president of Fox and Fox Entertainment News, his idea... He used to come into our offices and he would have lunch with Rupert, and he would come into our office and lie on our couch and watch CNN. He dreamed of a 24-hour news network on Fox. Rupert, on the other hand, after they would have lunch, went into the adjoining offices where they were doing other shows, Cops and Hard Copy, more sensational stuff. And Rupert would lie on their couch and watch cartoons. He was obsessed with cartoons, and hence what becomes the flagship show of the Fox network, The Simpsons. And I always thought that was interesting. And then it was more tragic when our little Fox Entertainment News had to come to an end. We made all the mistakes that had to be made to build a network news operation. And then the network news operation turned into what it is today. So I regretfully say I was on the ground floor of that. But nonetheless, it was a learning experience. The road took me into documentary filmmaking for A&E, initially A&E, then History Channel. I've done stuff with Discovery, Nat Geo, CNN as well, and a number of different projects. And today I'm just finishing up a project for an online university that's being created. And I did, it was supposed to be an hour, but right now it's at an hour and 16 minutes. Derek knows how things like this go. The series is called Great Books in History. And the books that I was assigned to deliver a documentary on were Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan, John Locke's Two Treatises of Government, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau's The Social Contract. And so I've been diving into deeply into 17th and 18th century political theory and enjoying it completely.
So cool.
That is epic.
That is. I was going to say.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know.
My
subjects have ranged, you know, from the ruby slippers to sex in World War II to now political theory. So
I love that. Diverse.
With a couple of side trips through the wormhole with Morgan Freeman.
Saw that. I know. I was like, wait, okay. All right. We see you. Well, this has been so much fun. We end every Slipperhood episode with just kind of a fun, light question. You can take it however you'd like. So the question we ask is, if you could design your very own pair of the ruby slippers, what would they look like? They could be silver. They could be ruby. They could be a Doc Marten. They could be a flip-flop. And if you don't even want to go the ruby slipper route, design your own pair of footwear.
Like what shoes are you rocking these days?
Since we're all about shoes today.
Well, I'm in the flip-flops and they have no jewels. Hopefully they have some sand on them from a nice beach.
Nice.
Love that.
I think the movie shoes are pretty perfect. And it's funny, I had an impression when I was a kid, because I watched it on television, and this is like, you know, 40 years ago when the resolution wasn't as good. I thought they were like a hard lacquer. I still have that in my mind, that they weren't like a scaly sequin, that the impression was something that I imagined as a child, that they were this hard lacquered shoe. And then in the book Wicked, he describes them as like a glassy candy situation. So I kind of wish it was the shoes in my childhood memory more than the actual shoes that I actually see, like the 85 year old shoes that we see today, which are, you know, old and raggy. But, you know, they're still beautiful in their way. But maybe the idealized version of the childhood shoe that I had would be nice. Not for me to wear, but
I take a pair of solid silver shoes, you know, the ones from the book, and melt them down for their silver.
Right.
That'd be great. Those will come in handy.
Now, in the book, it should be noted, in the book, the silver shoes make a tinkling sound on the yellow brick road. Metal on metal, ooh. Silver on gold. Very important part of the political. And of course, I told you I'm into political theory. Well, it starts with The Wizard of Oz, which is a political parable on 19th century populism. There's political theory in there.
Just this morning, as I was coming to set up for this interview, because I'm at MK Studio, my aunt just texted me like, hey, did you know like Elton John, when he met with his lyricist, is it lyricist Bernie Taupin? Am I saying that correctly?
Bernie Taupin. Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Their first movie they watched to like stoke their creative fires together was The Wizard of Oz. I was like, yeah, of course. Like that makes sense. It really is this like foundation to so many people's imaginations, or just like getting them to think differently about something. Cause it really can hold, I think, like you said, Reese, like our values and like what we are striving for. It's just so fascinating. And we have a million more questions for the both of you.
I know. We could be here for hours.
I know. This is just so delectable. It makes me want to go to college for a degree in the ruby slippers.
I will take your
so
course.
If you ever want to create a course on the ruby slipper.
Grace is like, no.
Not us. Emily has the torch. This could be Emily too.
I could be Emily too.
Other torch.
Yeah, I'm happy.
Derek and Reese, thank you so much from the bottom of our hearts for igniting our Slipperhood season for this Wicked Ears season. We're just so happy to have you both.
And thank you for your time today.
Well, it was nice meeting you too. Yeah. And it was nice seeing you again, Derek.
Yes, it was nice to see all of you, Reese, everyone. Yeah. Such a good time. Yeah. I could talk about this all day.
Yeah. And
let's keep going.
And then it would go into night.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. I mean, we'll pull a Debbie Reynolds, call you at midnight, you know, with some champagne.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Champagne first.
Oh. We're big fans of you. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you, listeners. We'll see you in our Wicked episodes.
Woohoo!
Tara, we have one tremendously talented pod squad full of healthcare workers, educators, collectors, and multidimensional artists.
Yes, we sure do. And one of those pod squad members includes graphic designer and illustrator Ashley Fletcher, whose Etsy and pop-up shop Good Witch of New York City, NYC, features fairy tale inspired clocks, prints, and jewelry, of course, including the Land of Oz.
You can find our favorite The Witches of Oz compass clock, stickers, and cards celebrating the original bomb color codes for each country, as well as a queer collection of Oz buttons and designs.
I even have tiny Wonderful Wizard of Oz book earrings. Mm-hmm. Ashley truly got both our book and movie lovers' backs in original designs.
Check out at Ashley L Portfolio on IG for upcoming sales and festival appearances, and Good Witch of NYC on Etsy, linked in show notes. Do you miss the days of off to see the wizard style, skipping down the aisles of your local video store to rent your favorite Oz movie?
I pine for my hometown Blockbuster and rented copy of Return to Oz on the daily.
I know! From the original 1939 classic to The Wiz, Return to Oz, like you said, and The Lion of Oz, these VHS tapes were a prized possession for any Oz fan growing up in the 80s and 90s. 724 Art is here to bring back all those Be Kind Rewind memories.
724 Art specializes in upcycling VHS tapes into one-of-a-kind nightlights. These unique nightlights are a perfect way to brighten up any room and bring back all those nostalgic vibes, or even introduce your children to what life was like before Netflix.
Got a favorite movie? 724 Art is ready to team up and make a custom. Each VHS comes paired with its original movie case and includes an extra set of batteries.
Shop an endless list of titles on Etsy and Instagram at 724 Art and Art724 on Etsy. Use code DTYBP1, that's initials for Down the Yellow Brick Pod with the number one, for 10% off. Link in show notes. Thanks, 724 Art.
Thank you so much for listening to Down the Yellow Brick Pod. We love linking arms with listeners like you.
Another special thank you to our Patreon Pod Squad members who have become our Bolina soup for the soul. Do you get it? And Oz family all across the globe. Consider joining us for as low as $3 a month. Patreon linked in show notes. More tiers and perks coming soon.
You can also find us over on IG at Down the Yellow Brick Pod. And someday, TikTok, and dropping Good Trouble Witch merch like it's hot on our Etsy shop. All links below. Shout out to our logo designer, Maddie Frank, for helping us make Oz nerddom fashion.
We'd like to dedicate this season to the late great co-host Drew of neighboring podcast of Slippers and Spindles, whose fairy tale enthusiasm always inspired ours. Blessed to have connected on Oz and Wicked and to have known you, Drew.
And lastly, if you are feeling the pod and haven't already, consider leaving us an Apple review. It truly makes our day. Each review also equals an entry into our big blowout end of the season giveaway. You won't want to miss this one, which will be completely swankified.
As always, all previous reviews will also be considered in our entries. We got you, boo.
See you over the rainbow soon.
In a clock tick.